I'm going to start off with a story. And I was like a good millennial searching YouTube one night. And they had like these little things that pop up. You can go through all these little clips that people think are awesome. And they go viral. And so you can kind of search through all of them. And this one guy is telling a story. And from his lips, it sounded like the God's honest truth. So I'm going to share it. So he knew this fella, or he heard about this fella, who was doing terrible in school. He was, can I use this mic here so I can walk around? I'm wanting to walk around all the time. I can't stop myself. Okay, thanks. And so he's doing terrible in school. He's not trying. He's failing all his classes. He's not even going half the time. And his mom's real disappointed in him, as a mom would be, right? And she's telling him, son, just go. Like, you're a smart guy. You can do great. You can go wherever you want. And he's like, well, mom, here's a compromise. I'll take the SAT, and we'll see what happens there. We'll see where I'm really land. And so she agrees to this, and he goes and he takes the SAT test. And I guess, as the story goes, it's like a bifurcated test. There's like language and that kind of side of the test, and there's like a science-y math side. And he takes the test, he comes home, he feels terrible about it, but then the results come in the mail. And there's 800 points on each side of the test. His score comes back as a 1460. And it's just ridiculous. Like, how could he get such a great score? That's like better than almost anybody you hear of. And so he realizes in that moment, somebody who gets this kind of score on the SAT does not fail out of high school. That's just not something they do. And so he goes and he doesn't fail out of high school. He goes and he does better than everybody else in his class. He excels to the top. And then he goes and later he gets invited to an Ivy League school. And he does what in his estimation is the best path his life could have taken. And he's making way more money than he ever thought he would have. But most of all, he's proud of himself and he feels responsible and like you know, a good class in society. You know, he feels like he's a good person. And then 11 years later, he gets a letter in the mail, and turns out he was one of five people the year he took the SAT that were given the wrong score. And his score was actually like a 700. And it's like, well, that's crazy. Can your belief really change that much about your life that it almost like fragments reality into something? I mean, like, where was he going? He was going nowhere. And then suddenly he realized how smart he really was. So in my life, I've seen moments like these, glimpses into something that's different than what I believe about myself. And each time I was like, wow, that's tantalizing. Incredible, really. And so I searched deeper for it. And where I always searched was into Adventism, specifically, I'd say. I'd look further deeper into Adventism, say, oh man, maybe I'll find more of this, something that I saw in somebody else or somewhere. And it went to the point where finally I was like, well, I'm going to get a theology degree at Walla Walla University. And I did that. And then, you know, now I'm working for my dad's business. But turns out the truth wasn't there. It never was. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Adventism isn't wrong, right? It's not a bad thing. But the truth cannot be contained in some entity that's inanimate. Where does the truth lie, really? God, yes, it lies in Jesus Christ. And where it lies bodily is in us. And so that's what this sermon is going to be about, is where the truth really lies and where we should not find our identity. And for me, I was searching all the wrong places. So the words we got here are the words from the beginning. Lance read us this verse. I'm going to read it one more time. See that what you have heard from the beginning remains in you. If it does, you will also remain in the Son and in the Father. And this is what he promised us, eternal life. So that's a good word right there. So, some theology stuff. So my theology degree wasn't completely useless. There was a lot of really interesting things that I learned that I think are really fun, and I think that they're interesting, like it says there. So, number one, things about Hebrew that are interesting. Hebrew is written from right to left. Now, this is just, you know, ordinary stuff. My friend last night, Jonathan, right there, he was telling me that if you look at Israel and you go every country to the right of that, right, on a map, they read their languages from right to left. But every country to the left of that reads their languages from left to right, which is just crazy. I didn't know that. That's pretty interesting. That's one thing about Hebrew. Another thing about Hebrew is the dots and things you see on all of these consonants, which are the main letters. How do I turn off the noise from the... Is there a way? I clicked the button I shouldn't have, apparently. And this is giving off a noise that nobody else can hear. It's like a dog whistle. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so never mind. The dots and things you see, if you can look at the, like right up here, okay, let's look at that. There's like a line there and there's dots all over the place. Those are actually the vowels in Hebrew. And so back before they had these even, they just had the consonants and there's just these big macro letters, right? And then they didn't even have the vowels to fill them in. You just kind of had to know what the word was. And so now they have these vowels and things, which are interesting, in my opinion. They're cool. And then the last thing you need to know, which is kind of obvious, right? The biblical Hebrew contains many clues that we don't pick up in our English translations. Like if you were to just learn Spanish tomorrow and somebody's using some innuendo in the Spanish language, you wouldn't catch it and you'd maybe think, well, that sentence made no sense. That's just utter nonsense. Well, if you look at the Hebrew, we can pick up on things that we wouldn't be able to otherwise see, which is fun. And so here's the things that I've seen from my Hebrew class that I thought were really cool and apply today. So three Hebrew words that we'll find in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Well, actually, it's just 2 and 3. So if you guys want to go there, might as well. Genesis 2, the last verse, we find our first word. And these are going to, I think, help us put context. Actually, let me go back for a second. This is an example of how these words can do something in Hebrew that is really cool. So the word for skins in Hebrew is or. And it's spelled with it's like an X-looking thing, and then a resh, which is an R, okay? And then the vowels fill in the rest of it, right? So that word is or, and that's how it's pronounced. And then there's another word that is pronounced exactly the same. It's called or, but it's spelled with an ion. It's like a Y first. That word means light. So skins and light are pronounced exactly the same, which is interesting because God clothed Adam and Eve in skins. And if you look at it in the Hebrew, you're looking at this word, or you're like, oh, you could replace that word with light. And it's just kind of fun. You know, like the authors do that on accident? Probably not. And this is another one of those things. The first word is in chapter 2, verse 25. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. And this is interesting because this is the only place in the Bible that I know of that naked is used in a positive context. Only place. Everywhere else it's used as, well, don't be that, or I'm scared and afraid because I am that. So this is the only place it's positive. And this word is pronounced arom, naked. Now, there's another word in the next verse, in chapter 3, and it says, now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? And that word crafty in the next verse is arum. So, in Hebrew, this is fun, in my opinion. Ayin is the first letter, and you're going from right to left, right? Then resh, then mem. Everything else is vowels. And that little line in crafty, that one line with a dot next to it, that's a vowel as well. That's the oo sound. And so really, these are the exact same root of the word. Same word. They just have different vowels kind of leading you to where it goes. Then the next word we have is down further in chapter 3, verse 11. And he said, who told you that you were naked? So this is how we have the next word, naked again. Naked again, but it looks different in chapter 3. And also it's negative now because they were afraid. And it's like, well, what happened between chapter 2 and chapter 3? We have naked in a positive sense in chapter 2 and negative in a naked in a negative sense. And it actually shows a physical difference in it too. It's arom instead of arom, but it's still the same root word. So the author can be telling us right now that there's something that's changed very distinctly to the point where you can see it. Like, you can't even, like, you can't really tell, right? It's so subtle. But something's changed between chapter 2 and chapter 3. What is it? What's the thing that's changed? So that's what we're going to talk about, because I think that this is crucial to understanding us. And it goes along with the story of Eve tempted, which is all the stuff in between there, right? So you have this crafty serpent who comes in and modifies our perception of naked to something else, and now it's negative. So what is that perception change? I'm going to read it to you. Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat from the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat from the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, the middle, and you must not touch it or you will die." So this is something fun that a friend pointed out to me. If you were the most crafty person, thing, animal, whatever in the world, you do crafty things, right? And this is how you set up a lie. If you're going to set up a lie, you don't just go straight for it. You kind of tantalize around it for a bit, right? And that's what the serpent does. He asks her first an obvious question, supposedly, and he's assuming the answer, but it's not actually the answer. He said, "God said that you could, or did God say you can't eat from any of the trees in the garden?" And Eve's like, "No, God didn't say that." So he's setting her on edge already. It's like, but at the same time, God did say we couldn't eat from one of them, so he's already setting up his point here, right? And she's making the point, and she doesn't know why the confusion's coming. And so he goes on, and she says, "You must not touch it or you will die." And he's like, "No, please, you won't surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasuring to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, which is interesting, right? He was right there observing this the whole time, and he ate it. So what happened there, really? Because here's what I've been given the impression of, and maybe it's just my faulty listening, right? But let's say we have Eve, right? And there's a fruit. And she's looking at it, and this serpent saying, "You can eat it, and you can become like God." And Eve is looking at this fruit, and in her mind, she's thinking, "Ooh, tantalizing, special. This is awesome, right? Because this is God-like power on a tree," or whatever. And in her arrogance and pride, thinking that she could be more than she was really meant to be, she picks it and eats, right? And I think that's completely bogus. Because there's no way on earth that's what Eve's thinking, because that's not crafty at all. That's not trickery in the least. That's not even deceptive, in my opinion, right? That's like doing the most obvious deception in the world, and somebody who's been walking with God in the garden every day is not going to fall for that nonsense. I think it's a lot more tricky than that. What changes Eve's perception? And so that brings us to Genesis 1, 26 to 31. And I think this is what John is talking about when he says the words in the beginning that we must remain in us, so that we remain in the Son and in the Father. So let's read those words. What are these words? And cleverly enough, if John did mean these words, it's the chapter titled "In the Beginning" in your books. So go to chapter 1 of the Bible, verse 26. "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground.' So God created man in his image. In the likeness of God, he created him." He didn't just say he was going to do it. He did it. "Male and female, he created him." Ooh, it's not very working today, is it? "God blessed them and said to them, 'Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and every living creature that moves on the ground.' Then God said, 'I give you every seed-bearing plant and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I will give every green plant for food.'" I kind of didn't delineate that correctly, but I think you get the point. "I give every green plant for food, and it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day." Those are the words in the beginning. That's what God says about each and every one of us, right? This is what he says about Eve and Adam. It was good. They're created in my likeness and image. So how crafty do you have to be to trick somebody out of that? You assume something at first, right? Can you become like God? The obvious answer is, of course not. And here's the reason. She was created like God all along, right? And so she believed the lie in that moment. She believed that she had to work to become like something she was. She was looking on the outside for what was on the inside and trying to achieve that through her works the entire time. That's a pretty messed up prank a woman would pull, right? That's crafty beyond belief because it's like looking for glasses on your head. You'll never see it until somebody points out that it's already on you, right? Because you'll be looking everywhere else for this thing that's yours all along. It's crafty, and it requires a pretty radical solution, in my opinion. So here's a question. Do we have to work for our salvation, or is it a gift already given? Yeah, it's a gift. I think Adventists get this pretty right, right? I think people in general in the Christian church get this pretty right, you know, half the time, right? So just to back up my point here, this doesn't happen just once, right? This happens everywhere. It happens to every human, right? Because we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And so Jesus was tempted just like Eve, right? Because that's how the devil tempts. He tempts in the way that works. And so he comes to Jesus after Jesus had just risen out of the water of baptism, and his father came down in dove-like form and says, "This is my son in whom I'm well pleased." And then Jesus goes into the wilderness to be tempted, right? And the tempter comes, the accuser, Satan, and he says, "If you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread." And those are his words, right? If you're the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. And Jesus' reaction to this is, are you kidding me? Like, I was there, man. I saw from the beginning when you did this to Eve. I've seen you do this to every single human being since. And you can't trick me out of belief in my Father. I'm not going to doubt for a second because I know who my Father is. In fact, 6 verses earlier or whatever it is, he told me who I was. He told me, "You are my son in whom I'm well pleased," right? And so, and knowing this, right, Jesus can step forward without even giving a second thought to this doubt that's trying to be cast on him, this crafty doubt that's worked on all of us, right? And instead he says, "Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that flows from the mouth of God," the words from the beginning, the only words that matter in definition of you and me, because those are the words that matter, right? And so, if we go on, I don't even know what my next slide is, we're gonna find out here. Double-minded, oh, this is good. So, this is what I struggle with in my life, right? I heard the truth, I believed the truth slightly, I saw it in people who had it dwelling inside them bodily because Jesus Christ was in them. And I heard great words about the truth, and here's truth words right here. I am a child of God. Truth words. Christ died for my sins. Truth words. Salvation not by works, but by faith. Truth words. Truth words that we hear all the time. I can call sin out for what it is, because sin does not define me. My Father does. It's not keep grace at all, right? Because nobody who's living in this pardons sin, because sin isn't who I am. I will call sin out for what it is. But here's the thing. I think we live in a time of double-minded speaking, of two-way talk. And here's what double-minded speaking is, right? If you go to James 1, in your Bibles, he talks about the double-minded man. And I think this is a time that we live in very clearly and something we can see in our society and in our culture, even as Adventists, really, really clearly. Maybe especially as Adventists at sometimes. Because Adventists say all the right words, don't they? You see that left column there, truth? They say all the right words, but then they say all the wrong words. You know? Like, it's not just the right words that we say. And I've caught myself saying all the wrong words before, and we'll go over the wrong words in a second here. But James, I'm getting to James. Why can I not find James? There we go. James 1. We're going to start in verse 2. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt. Because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. So here's a question for you. When we speak double-mindedly, why should we expect anything from God? Right? If it's about faith and belief, and we speak double-mindedly about the entire prospect of the Bible, of the gospel, why should we expect anything from God? And here's some lies that I hear all the time. I am not worthy. Lie. I am a sinner. Lie. You may sin, but that's not what defines you. That's not what your Father says you are. He calls you righteous and redeemed, right? He calls you raised of the blood and worthy of the purchase, right? I have to do more, be better. When your heart tells you you screwed up, right? Say, I'll do better next time. And this is cheap grace. This is real cheap grace. Cheap grace says, I'm a sinner. I'm not worthy. I have to do more, be better. But thank God he exists. That's cheap grace. That's nothing. That's pardoning sin. Another lie. I have to keep it a secret. Because if I tell the truth, what kind of tree am I? Lie. Okay, so that's what I see a lot of. And can you imagine if we said the truth without the lie? If we believed without a hint of doubt in us? I know a guy who he does a lot of YouTube and whatnot, and he's struggling with his faith, right? He lives his life as though God exists, is what he says. And he's impacted a lot of people's lives through things that he's shared. And so he talks about life as like, there's a narrative story and there's reality, right? And every once in a while, those touch and you can see it. And it's beautiful. And he makes him cry when you hear him talk about it. And the most real example of that is Jesus, right? Living the truth out in bodily form, the narrative out in life, right? The narrative and reality, they touch and they come into being. And he's sitting there almost in tears. He's like, I just don't know what would happen if I fully believed. If I were to fully believe, I can't imagine what kind of an explosion that would be on the world. Because right now, I'm struggling with doubt, right? I say I believe that God exists. Can you imagine if I've totally let go? How can I? I think personally, I can kind of see glimpses of what faith would be, true faith. And yet, at the same time, I know that there's more to it that I have yet to be taught by my Father, because the faith that I have is lacking often, but it's not lacking because Christ lives in me. He's the author and finisher, so he's bringing it out. So can you imagine what would happen if we had a community of people who didn't live by lies as well, right? Because they live by truth and lies, right? But only lifted you up in truth. When you felt like you were down, like you were wrong, like you were out, they lifted you up and said, no, that's not what your Father says about you. Here's the reality. He told you in Ephesians 1 that you were thought of before the beginning of the world, that you have every spiritual blessing and every gift. If that's what we told each other, if that's what we told our brothers and sisters and lifted them up instead of dragging them down and believing the lie with them whenever they state it or live it out in their lives. So this is what I think is the best news in the Bible. This is my favorite verse ever, and I think it tells us the story quite clearly. 1 John 2. This is how we know that we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence. If our hearts condemn us, We know that God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. Those are the words in the beginning. He's greater than our hearts. When your hearts lie, when you believe those feelings, and feelings aren't lords, ladies and gentlemen. They aren't the thing that tells us the truth about ourselves, right? When we believe those things, that's not belief in our Father. Even though our hearts condemn us, we know that God speaks a better word than our hearts. And here's the thing that makes, right? Fireworks. That's the best news in the world. That's exciting, and that's life-changing. And that's the gospel.